Ni hao, Dong Schmidt. Welcome to another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN, republicbroadcasting.org. It's truly the People's Republic Broadcasting Network. And that's what I call it. So go to republicbroadcasting.org, click on the donate button, send the shekels. 2155. Is that what it is? 2155. Double Creek Drive, Round Rock, Texas, 78664. Phone it into 1-800-724-2719. Extension 3. I think I got it right. Anyway, go do that right now. So we have with us Cato. Cato, welcome to the show.
Well, it's good to be back. Hope everyone had a Thanksgiving. They were able to spend time with their family, quality time. It is December 1st. This is the day we're recording it. Man, it's already December. I mean, this year just flew by like it was nothing. I mean, I remember January 1st, 2023, like it was yesterday. It's, I guess it's true that, you know, the older you get, the faster time goes.
Just starts spinning out of control. Yeah, I spent my Thanksgiving watching the Chicago Thanksgiving parade and talking to Dr. Duke on the phone and recording a very extensive show, which I've already broadcast. He's going to broadcast it next week in two parts. So,
what's the little teaser? What's the subject? Well, other than Jewish power, but like specific.
Jewish power. It was Jewish power. But,
just
you know,
general. Yeah.
Sometimes when we're talking, especially not on live radio, but when it's live radio, for whatever reasons, sometimes he gets kind of excited and it's hard to control. But when we're recording, sometimes he starts interviewing me, which he doesn't do as much on a live broadcast. And so sometimes it teases out some new ideas. One new thing that came out of it was a corollary to Gilad Atzmon's often quoted observation that the essence of Jewish power is the ability to prevent the discussion of Jewish power. And my corollary is, the discussion of Jewish power is the destruction of Jewish power. So that's what we're doing. We're discussing it. And it's starting to be discussed more and more. Now, not so much because of what I do. It's being discussed more and more
because of what they do.
Yeah, because of Jewish behavior, especially like the past couple months in Gaza. It's disgusting, and so people are discussing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's becoming, it's definitely much more widespread today than it was, you know, even when you and I were doing when I first started doing the show with you, even then it wasn't as widespread as it is now. So, I mean, that's, I guess, something, you know, to be, you know, thankful for, you know, that has, you know, stirred up more discussion of Jewish power, you know, in some way, shape, or form, even if it's still, you know, at a, you know, very superficial level, you know, in terms of how normal people discuss it. But at least, you know, they're discussing it in some way.
If they don't want people discussing Jewish power, then they shouldn't be doing things like genociding Gazans. Norman Finkelstein, I was listening to the Candace Owens podcast from a couple of weeks ago. And it was her last podcast before she went on maternity leave. And she had on Norman Finkelstein. And Norman Finkelstein, among others, but he brought up the fact that that Prime Minister Netanyahu made a speech, public speech, where he said that what they're doing in Gaza, this is a war on Amalek, which I'm not that well versed in the Old Testament, but Amalek was a enemy for the Jews, and the war on Amalek required them to required the Jews to kill everybody, complete genocide. So if you're referring to the operation in Gaza as a war on Amalek, and I don't even know if I'm pronouncing it right, but people out there know what I'm talking about. They know what I'm talking about. They might be saying, I don't know what I'm talking about, but they know what I'm talking about. And that, how can you interpret that as anything other than a vow to Jews in Israel that you are trying to completely destroy and genocide the Gazans? So
yeah, but basically Amalek, you know, was the Amalekites were a tribe in the Old Testament that were completely wiped out by the Hebrews at the time. And you know, whether you believe you know, you're a Christian, you know, you believe the Old Testament, you know, that was justified or not, or whatnot, or whether you believe that those were the Jews or not of today, you know, descended. That's besides the point. The point is that's how the Jews view all of us, you know, Gentiles that stand in the way of their Jewish power and Jewish hegemony as Amalek. That's how the Jews interpret, you know, using that Old Testament in their own minds, interpret us. You know, anyone who stands in their way, whether they be Palestinians or you know, European nationalists or you know, anyone that just calls out Jewish power, they say, oh, these are Amalekites. They need to be wiped out. That's how the Jews see it. So, you know, and by the way, I'm surprised I know so much, you know, biblical history, despite, you know, being Chinese. Well, that's because I grew up in a Christian society. So what was a Christian society? I'll put it that way.
Well, you're doing a better job at it than I am, and so thank you for that. Just like the Chinese people do a better job at playing the violin than Americans on average. But
yeah, than most of the descendants of Beethoven and Mozart.
but thank you for that. So, I mean, the thing is, like you pointed out, if you're a Christian who looks at the Hebrews of the Old Testament as being the good guys, fine. That's not what we're talking about. We're not arguing about that. What we are saying is that in the Old Testament, the war on the Amalekites was a war of complete, you know, it was a holy war of complete annihilation. And so if he is invoking this, if Netanyahu is evoking this in talking about the operation in Gaza, what he is saying and what his Jewish Israeli audience is understanding is that this is a war of annihilation. So the war against the Amalekites wasn't just simply to destroy their militia and their tunnels. It was to kill them all. And so, you know, this is something that Norman Finkelstein raised with Candace Owens, but I mean, it's, you know, it's something that's the Jewish behavior right now in Gaza is it's disgusting, but B, like militarily, this has just been a retarded strategy for them. Now they're talking about having this war would go on for 1 year. It's not going to be allowed to go on for 1 year. The Jews in Israel have been able to get away with as much as they've gotten away with over the past decades because of the United States' position as their protector. Their United States, the past 30 years during the unipolar moment, which I'm starting to redub Cold War II, but during that unipolar moment, the United States was the world hegemon, and so Israel could get away with what it wanted. Jews controlled the United States during that era, and they let Israel get away with whatever it wanted. And during the Cold War, Israel couldn't necessarily get away with whatever it wanted, but even in the context of the Cold War, the United States, as at least a co-equal of the two superpowers, was able to afford Israel a great deal of protection. Moving into this new international order, and notice I'm not saying new world order, okay? Moving into this new international order where it's multipolar, but the China-Russia axis, and I'll say axis because axis are the good guys, this Russia-China axis is dominant, is going to be dominant. And the United States cannot give Israel a blank check anymore. So Israel is not going to be able to fight in Gaza for a year. It's not going to happen. And the longer they fight, the longer this goes on, the longer the Israelis are committing atrocity, the more the events of October 7th, which many people looked at those events with some sympathy to Israel, the more that recedes from the memory and becomes insignificant. So in many ways, that's kind of politically, but even militarily, to bomb all the streets, turn the streets into rubble, and then go in with tanks in order to detect tunnels. How does that work? Once the tank can't go through the street of rubble, but people can pop out of tunnels and use anti-tank weaponry, right?
Mm-hmm. The Israelis are going to exhaust themselves eventually. In fact, in some ways, they already are exhausting themselves. And in the long run, I mean, they're going to lose. Because, you know, and I hate to make this comparison. These two major battles have no parallel and nothing in common with each other. But, you know, like in Stalingrad, you know, when the German had far superior, weapons and artillery. But when, all the buildings, crumbled, what the Red Army, the Soviets did, they hit, the so-called, resistance fighters, in Russia, they hid in the rubble and ambushed, German soldiers going in. And again, I'm not trying to make that comparison because, clearly, Stalingrad, the good guys were the Germans, the bad guys were the Soviets. But in this case, the Palestinians are the resistance fighters. They're the ones that are fighting the occupation of the Zionist Israelis. But they're the ones that are, dug in now. And it's very, very difficult. I mean, tunnel warfare is probably one of the most asymmetrical forms of warfare out there. And it's whoever can navigate through the tunnel and the rubble the most that usually wins.
I wonder which side that will be.
Yeah, but I mean, the Israelis, I mean, they're exhausting, just like the Ukraine. They're both exhausting their resources. And it's the more they try to keep this up, the more, the harder they're going to lose. Ukraine has pretty much exhausted all its resources. It's finished. It has been finished for quite a while, but now it's so obvious. Even the mainstream media has to acknowledge it. Same thing's going to happen to Israel.
Yeah, I mean, even Zelensky is pretty much admitting it. He gave an interview to, he gave an interview to somebody, I can't remember, and is saying that the summer offensive has ended and it did not achieve its objectives. And you've got pretty much open feuding between Zelensky and his chief general, Zaluzhny. Neither one of them can get rid of the other. Zaluzhny, maybe the army could overthrow Zelensky, but at the...
What did they have left?
for the time being, the United States and European donors wouldn't look at that favorably. And Zelensky would like to fire Zaluzhny, but the army wouldn't probably let him do that. So they're kind of stuck with each other.
If he did, then the army would have nothing to lose by overthrowing Zelensky.
Yeah, they would have nothing to lose. And you've got CIA chief William Burns, who is a career diplomat. He actually kind of is a diplomat. He went to Ukraine last month, and the rumors are that he's trying to push that at least some forces in the Biden, some elements of the fake Biden administration are trying to push Zelensky to negotiate for peace. Well, how can he? Really, how can he? What credibility would he have with anybody after having spent almost 2 years saying that Ukraine is going to recapture Crimea?
Ukraine's going to come out of this stronger. They're going to be a wonderful liberal democracy, a liberal utopia.
The longer this has gone on, the worse the situation is, the worse the future is for Ukraine. And of course, you've, according to Russian Defense Minister Shoigu, this summer offensive, summer counteroffensive, cost Ukraine something like 125,000 troops dead, on top of the 100.
Even the Pentagon paper, you know, that leak that the Pentagon was like, you know, scrambling over themselves to do damage control. Even that Pentagon papers leak said it was like, what, 8 to 9 Ukrainians dead for every 1 Russian? Something like that.
Yeah. It's incredible that way. And the Ukrainians are on the verge of another round of mobilization, which, I mean, already they've got, what is it, from age 18 to 60, they've mobilized men from 18 to 60. And I think now they're going to stretch it from 16 to 70 and also include women.
They might as well start conscripting, you know, infants and toddlers. And I mean, because that's all there's going to be.
And for the fake Biden administration, what can they tell the American people? Because it's going to be obvious that Ukraine lost the war after 22 months of hearing how Ukraine is winning harder and harder every day. They keep winning so hard. And then all of a sudden, half of the country is going to get annexed to Russia. You can't hide that. And you hear Planet of the Apes general, what's his name? I can't remember his name.
Oh, what's his face? Austin? Who's that? Who's that general in Planet of the Apes, that stupid movie, the one from the 2000s? You know, he's like, his face replaces Abraham Lincoln's, you know, his, you know what I'm talking about?
I didn't see the movie. I try to remember that name.
I haven't either, but I've seen a clip of it. You know, it's like the Lincoln Memorial, but it's that general, that ape's face. Yeah, that's who Lloyd Austin kind of reminds me of.
Except
not as competent.
That's what I want to call him. And so Lloyd Austin will say that, oh well, you know, the real purpose of this war, it wasn't to push the Russians out of Ukraine, or it wasn't, you know, of course, the true purpose was to try to topple Vladimir Putin, but he'll say it was to degrade the Russian military. Really? So it's okay to completely destroy a country and have hundreds of thousands of its young men die and millions of its people go into exile, never to return again, completely destroy this country just to degrade the military of one of your potential enemies? And of course, even that's a lie, because Russia is so much stronger. Their ability, their industrial capacity to manufacture weapons is much greater than it was 2 years ago. Their international relations, their alliance structures are much stronger than they were 2 years ago. And their army is huge. They have been recruiting something like 80,000 troops a month. People are joining the Russian military, which is going to total 1.5 million men, not trannies, not women, but men, real men.
Patriotic men ready to die for their nation, for their motherland.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's over for, U.S. hegemony around the world. I mean, the liberal hegemonic international order is being replaced with the multipolar international order.
Yeah,
that's what it is.
You can make all. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, well, go ahead, because I'm gonna shift gears a little bit.
I was gonna say you can make all sorts of critiques about, you know, the American ruling class 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 150 years ago. But I don't know.
Oh, know that it's strong, but it's much too strong to let it go now. We meet every day at the same cafe, 6:30. Yeah, no one knows she'll be there. Holding hands, making all kinds of plans, while the jukebox plays a favorite song. Me and Mrs. Jones. We got a thing going on. We both know that it's wrong, but it's much too strong to let it go now. We gotta be extra careful that we don't build our hopes up too high. 'Cause she.
Class 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 150 years ago. But I don't know. I don't have that harsh a view on American history. It's if you compare American history to history of other countries, there's a lot of the American project was well-intentioned or at least benign. But it really, really became a train wreck during my lifetime, during your lifetime. You're not as old as me. It's just become a complete train wreck. And I completely welcome the United States' position in the world being coming down by several notches, because the United States state apparatus, the government, has come under the control, thoroughly under control, of people who don't have the best interests of the American people at heart and are actively working against our interests. And so it just needs to be taken down.
Yeah. And even the people too. I mean, just, you know, it's like, I hate to say it, but like, yeah, as every day goes by, it's like the less and less really respect I have for the American people as a whole. I mean, you know, you look at how, I mean, forget the liberal left. Let's just focus on, you know, the so-called the red states, you know, the conservatives out there. I mean, as soon as you know, Israel, you know, started, you know, mass murdering innocent Palestinians, many of whom are Christian, by the way, all that attention that, you know, focus on, you know, basically, you know, what the federal government was doing, suddenly went to focus on Israel and all, it's, you know, well, we got to support Israel. Oh, Israel first. Israel's America's last hope. The only reason, I mean, there's even some, you know, crazy, you know, whack job, you know, fundamentalist Baptist pastors in the South. You know, it's primarily the Bible Belt region of the American South. That's what the American South is to all the European listeners. It's called the Bible Belt because it's known for evangelical Christianity. You know, they just dug in their heels, you know, when it came to Israel. And this is supposed to be the lesser of two evils, you know, with the other side being, you know, complete global homo, you know, gay anal trannies and you know, all that, and massive third world, you know, demographic replacement immigration, you know, that's on one side. But then on this other side, you got, these really, I call them Zionist rednecks. Because that's what they are. I mean, they're Zionists, but they're rednecks. And I use that in the, you know, the sense that they're ignorant of a lot of things. And you don't, I'm not saying rednecks are bad. I'm not trying to, you know, do that stereotype. There's a lot of, you know, good rednecks out there, you know. But, I mean, they're Zionist rednecks. They're ignorant, and they refuse to hear the truth. Anyway, I'm just rambling. I'm just ranting.
Mm-hmm. Well, but you look at... Like I'm a people person, and I'm out there a lot, and I see what's going on at all levels in American society. And you know, you can go to a Walmart or wherever, go out to a supermarket, go out where you find people, and what you're seeing, especially with the young people, is the feminization of American men. So you're seeing, you know, whether they're gay or even if they're not gay. They're out of shape. The older people are really unhealthy. The very old people are just strung out. You see them in long lines at prescription counters and drug. So they're on all sorts of medications. Everybody's in really bad shape. The Social Security disability payments are through the roof. So many people are claiming disability in their 40s and 50s. So you got a country that is completely unhealthy. It's not productive. It's not working, and it's being flooded with these foreigners, some of whom are productive, some of whom you'll see up on roofs doing roofing work or construction work, but typically having large families of children that are going to be hard to educate and expensive to educate, and then also, even the people up on roofs. They're kind of fat, right? The Central Americans up there.
Yeah, but that's the thing. The ones that have been taken over by Southern Mexicans and Central Americans.
Yeah, and they've got like high rates of pre-diabetes and diabetes. These are going to be very expensive people to take care of for the healthcare system. They're referred to derisively as squatomalians, but really, they're not very healthy. Our people aren't healthy. It's really bad. And then you look over like Russia. I don't know. I guess Russian people, they've got problems with alcoholism. They might have problems with weight. But you look at the Chinese people, and so Chinese people are in a lot better shape. East Asians in general are in better shape. It hasn't deteriorated so much over there. And the idea that the United States somehow that are, you know, militarily, economically, or even politically, that we're going to continue to dominate. No, it's over. It's over, and people need to wake up and smell coffee, smell the jasmine tea.
Mm-hmm. It's just, I mean, it's obvious. You know, just look around. I mean, American, you know, peoples are decaying. They're you know, decaying. I mean, you know, I mean, yeah, everywhere you go, there's all these kind of health problems. But... You know, I just put your gears a little bit to
Thank you.
Everywhere you go, there's all these kind of health problems. But, you know, I guess switching gears a little bit, you know, we were talking about how, you know, Jewish power, you know, global, you know, Jewish power is declining, you know, at a fast rate. Not at a fast, you know, I wish it were faster, but I mean, it is, you know, getting weaker and weaker as we speak. And that's primarily because the United States is getting weaker and weaker. Well, I mean, you know, this week, you know, a few days ago, in fact, yeah, a key figure in, you know, global Jewish power, in fact, one of the key important figures, died, finally. He was 100 years old, and it took him that long to finally die. And that, of course, is Henry Kissinger.
Yeah, Henry Kissinger. You know, I remember Henry Kissinger from his days as National Security Advisor to Richard Nixon. He started that in 1969. He always, even in the early days of the Nixon administration, he always overshadowed the Secretary of State. He eventually became both Secretary of State and National Security Advisor at the same time in the second short-lived Nixon administration. But people don't even remember Nixon's first Secretary of State. His name was William Rogers. And William Rogers didn't know what was going on. Henry Kissinger ran things. And overall, I think you have to give Henry Kissinger bad grades because he kept the Vietnam War going much longer than it needed to be going on. He expanded the war, bombing Laos, invading Cambodia.
Supporting Pol Pot. Let's not forget that. Supporting Pol Pot.
Yeah, he was a disaster for Southeast Asia. And he had his tentacles in other places. Now, there's a couple of things he did, which if you take a really, I don't know, maybe a cynical and Machiavellian viewpoint, and he was a very Machiavellian character.
He cited Machiavelli many times in his interviews.
Yeah. And so his policy, you had the United States. This is the Cold War. You had the United States and the Soviet Union. They were the two big actors in the Cold War. And then China. Yeah, China. And if you're talking about the early 1970s, China was still under Mao. Mao was not in great shape, but China, and it was in the midst of the Cultural Revolution. But Henry Kissinger made a secret visit to China. He made a secret visit to China. And the idea was for the United States to improve relations with China and with the Soviet Union, thereby allowing China and the China-Soviet rift to take greater priority. It was basically to get, because China and the Soviet Union had a split in the 1950s that had to do with Khrushchev denounced Stalin and things like that.
Yeah, and, Soviet revisionism, as Mao called it, under Khrushchev, and Mao wanted to, you know, take a more hardline Stalinist approach. Maoist approach, but Mao admired Stalin but hated Khrushchev.
And so part of the de-Stalinization program in the Soviet Union centered around the destruction of the cult of personality, because Stalin built himself a cult of personality, and he kind of built a post-mortem cult of personality around Lenin. But there was a cult of personality around Stalin. And then after World War II, when you wound up getting communist governments in Eastern Europe and then in China, subsequently in China, these communist governments in other countries followed suit, and their leaders adopted cults of personality. Mao did that. Maybe he would have done it anyway, but he adopted a cult of personality. And so when Khrushchev denounced not just Stalin, but really denounced the cult of personality, it undermined all of these other leaders. And you did see replacement of the Eastern European leaders who were satellites of Russia. China was, even though it was very undeveloped, it was too big and had too much latent strength to just be a satellite of the Soviet Union. So Mao was able, as Khrushchev famously went to China in 1955 or something, and apparently when he got off the phone, got off the plane and met with Mao, Mao had some very harsh words for him. But so Mao had the cult of personality. But at any rate, Kissinger, the idea was Russia and China have bad relations. To the extent that we can improve our relations with both countries, then that frees them up to fight each other.
Yeah, it was very pragmatic. I mean, Kissinger, I mean, even though he was an evil Jew, basically, I mean, he was very pragmatic in, you know, how he approached world affairs. And he was not so, you know, unhinged idealistic like, you know, what we have now, you know, with Blinken and so forth, you know, just totally unreasonable and you know, like wanting to achieve the impossible. Kissinger was not that. He was very pragmatic. He was very realistic. And that he understood, you know, how things are and how things play out. So that's why, you know, I mean, Kissinger compared to, you know, what we got now, you know, whether it be, you know, Blinken or whoever, I mean, Kissinger was considered, you know, very level-headed compared to, you know, now. Which, you know, that begs the interesting question, I wonder, because I remember, you know, last year, or 2 years ago when Kissinger said that, you know, we really shouldn't be provoking Russia any more than we are, or, you know, we should go back to, you know, diplomacy. Everyone, you know, all these, you know, these current, you know, elites, they all attack Kissinger and said that, oh, Kissinger is, you know, then suddenly they want to bring up all his crimes. You know, before that, they said good things about him. Now suddenly they want to bring up all his crimes because he, you know, said that this is unhinged. This is insane. Just for saying that. So it makes me wonder. It's like, maybe if, I mean, obviously Kissinger was 100 years old already, which, you know, I mean, the way he made it to 100, you know, that's a whole nother story. But it's like, it makes me wonder. It's like, if Kissinger would have, you know, touted the, you could say, the mainstream neocon, you know, narrative, which is, oh, we gotta provoke Russia, we gotta provoke China, we gotta provoke Iran. I wonder if he'd still be alive. If he would have, you know, said the mainstream narrative. Neocon narrative.
Yeah, well, I remember my mother, she was not a big fan of Henry Kissinger. In fact, I don't know if she was present, but she was watching on C-SPAN some event that he was at where he sat down in his chair and leaned back, and then the chair fell off the stage. And my mother is a very nice person, but she said, she admitted that she had to laugh when he fell off the stage.
That is pretty funny.
Well, because he really wasn't a sympathetic character, but the United States has gone so far off the rails that over the past year and a half, Henry Kissinger emerged as a voice of reason. That's how far that that the United States has gone off the rails, that that Henry Kissinger emerged as a voice of reason. Henry Kissinger was somebody that the Russians and the Chinese were willing to talk to. Putin would talk to Kissinger once a year or so. Kissinger would fly over to Russia, and Kissinger and Putin would talk to him. The Chinese would not talk to, like, over the past year, Xi Jinping has not been taking Biden's phone calls. To the extent Tony Blinken goes to China, they humiliate him. They'll humiliate him. At least Kissinger, these foreign leaders would talk to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because like I said, even though he's in the same boat with what we have now as you know, controllers in the West. I mean, but he at least, you know, is somewhat more sane and you know, reasonable than what we have now, and realistic.
So I heard, I don't know the guy's name. He was some colonel he speaks with a southern accent, not unusual for a colonel, a retired colonel. And he had been, what was his name, Colonel Wilkinson or something? And he had been Colin Powell's chief of staff when Colin Powell was Secretary of State, something like that. Colin, you know what people who observe Colin Powell are called? Or act of observing Colin Powell, you know what that's called?
People who are observing Colin Powell?
Observing Colin Powell, do you know what that is called?
Something to do with colon.
Yeah, it's a colonoscopy. Anyway, instrument. I'm just developing this on the fly. Yeah, that's the instrument that you use to look at Colin Powell with, is a colonoscopy. I don't know. Anyway, I'll get it. One day it will be funny, okay? One day it will be funny. Not yet, though. Anyway, he was on this Colonel Wilkinson, I believe that was his name, was on talking to Alexander Mercurius. And he was talking about the American foreign policy establishment. And he was just going through, you know, name by name and saying, they're stupid. They're stupid. Tony Blinken is stupid. Jake Sullivan is stupid. Joe Biden is stupid. Victoria Nuland is not stupid, but she's horrible. She's evil. She's got, you know, it was kind of funny. But Kissinger wasn't stupid. But I don't think he did America any favors. And let's not forget, here we are in the midst of this. He emerged as a voice of reason to an extent, talking about the Russia and Ukraine. And even then, a voice of reason only relative to the American State Department, because he was always proposing solutions that were like 2 years behind, 2 years too late. You know, and he was talking about a Russian pullout and something like, it was like, well, you could have done that 2 years ago. It's too late now. So even then he was too late. It's just he wasn't saying that Ukraine's going to win like the rest of the foreign policy establishment. But remember, 50 years ago, when you had the Yom Kippur War, that was October 1973, you had the Yom Kippur War. And in the midst of that, at the risk of escalating to a nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union, Kissinger had the Nixon administration send weaponry in the midst of that war, airlift weaponry to Israel. And this was something that, you know, it possibly could have provoked an escalation that would have led to World War III with Russia, with the Soviet Union. And he did it anyway. And that's completely inexcusable. And had he not done that, and had the Syrians and the Egyptians, if they had retained these territories that they had recaptured from Israel, because what happened is they recaptured territory, much of the territory, probably most of the territory that they had lost in 1967. And then Kissinger airlifts weaponry to Israel, and Israel captures the territory that it had originally captured in 67. Well, then that set up that set the stage for today. If had that not happened, you may well have had a resolution of this issue 50 years ago. And I just want to bring that up.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's that's the thing. It's like, you know, some things, you know, that we're seeing today, you know, played out in, you know, their favor there, you know, meaning the bad guys who ruled over us, and then some things did not. Like, I think the rise of China becoming a first world superpower was not in the playbook. I mean, was not in the minds of these bad guys. And I know I'm using simple terms here, but they are bad guys, you know, that rule over. I think they were expecting China to just be a subservient peoples, you know, like they're trying to, you know, they have done to a lot of white Americans, but China didn't. China used that to their advantage, turned the tables against them. And as a result of that, you know, they can't get away with whatever they wanted to get away with like they could before.
So here's something I want to bring up before we run out of time. The United Nations Security Council, it consists of 15 members, 5 permanent members, and those being the United States, United Kingdom, France, the Russian Federation, and the People's Republic of China. Those are the 5 permanent members. And then you have 10 other members that are elected for 2-year terms, representing regions, basically continents. And there are, you know, 2 years. And then you have a chairmanship. The non-permanent members can't serve consecutive terms. But there's some that keep getting elected over and over again. Like Japan tries to get elected to represent Asia at least, you know, once every 4 years or once every 6 years. And they're on the Security Council now. Japan's on, Brazil's on. I think the United Arab Emirates is on. But at any rate, the chairmanship of the UN Security Council rotates among these 15 members, and they will chair it for 1 month. Well, last month, the month of November, was China's turn to chair it. And in what I thought was a very interesting development, China invited Columbia professor Jeffrey Sachs to speak before the assembly, before the Security Council. And Jeffrey Sachs just had a scathing denunciation of American foreign policy regarding, in particular, Ukraine.
Hello.
Regarding.
There we go.
Yeah. You hear me now? Yeah.
We lost you for a few seconds.
Yeah. David Duke tried to call me, and I will call back in a couple minutes. But at any rate, it was a scathing denunciation of American policy towards Ukraine and Russia, towards Israel or towards Palestine, its support for blind support for Israel, their efforts to regime change Syria, and the successful effort to regime change Libya and create this power vacuum and war in West Africa. It was a scathing denunciation. And obviously the Chinese knew exactly what Jeffrey Sachs was going to say, because he speaks in public all the time. And so they had him in effect lecture the Americans and the French and the British and I guess Japanese. You know, they have a few allies on the Security Council. So there's Jeffrey Sachs giving this lecture to the forces of Zionism. Oh.
好棒，只有哆啦 A 梦可以带着我实现梦想。可爱圆圆胖脸胖，小小叮当挂身上，总会在我不知所措的时候给我帮忙。带想象的天堂，穿越了时光，来，我们坐上时光机。每天过得都一样，偶尔会突发奇想，只要有了哆啦 A 梦，幻想就无限延长。是与我分享，难过时陪在身旁，掏掏他的神奇口袋，就能把烦恼遗忘。找传说的宝藏，冒险到远方，看我的任意门。啊啊啊！哆啦 A 梦和我一起，让梦想发光。只有哆啦 A 梦可以带着我实现梦想。可爱圆圆胖脸胖，小小叮当挂身上，总会在我不知所措的时候给我帮忙。高想象的天堂，穿越了时光，看，是竹蜻蜓。
And the French and the British and I guess Japanese, you know, they have a few allies on the Security Council. So there's Jeffrey Sachs giving this lecture to, you know, the forces of Zionism. And the essence of what he was saying, especially regarding the what's going on with Gaza and Israel, is 242. You already have the solution to this crisis. It's UN Resolution 242. UN Security Council Resolution 242, which was passed in November 1967. It calls on Israel to go back to its pre-June 1967 borders immediately. And he was calling on the United Nations to immediately recognize the independence of Palestine and admit it as a member. And so that's what that those words were coming out of Jeffrey Sachs's mouth. But Russia and China and Brazil have been working together diplomatically to make this the solution, that Israel has to withdraw from all these territories. And this would wind up including the Golan Heights for Syria. And it these 700,000 Israeli settlers, they would be they're illegally, they would have to be removed. This would be a massive setback for the Zionist agenda. Although honestly, for anybody wanting to lead a normal life in Israel, this would actually be a good thing. If, you know, if, because Israel, the only way Israel and Israelis can ever live at peace is if they have peace imposed on them from outside, because they will never live peacefully on their own.
Exactly. That's the thing. I mean, what was I'll put it this way. What was wrongfully done to the Germans after World War II, where they were militarily imposed upon by the, you know, victorious allies, needs to be done to the Zionist state of Israel. What was wrongly done to the Germans after World War II needs to be rightfully imposed on these Zionists, these crazy Zionists, who they need to be taught a lesson. They need to be taught you cannot go around killing and, you know, oppressing and taking away, you know, the life, the family, the liberty, the property of other peoples for your, because you think you're better than them. That's what
there
it is.
You go. And yeah, it's because of Russia and China and the alliance systems and international institutions that they are creating. Because of that, a better world is within reach.
Yes. Speaking of a better world, I mean, December is, you know, as some of you might know, is probably my favorite month because it is Christmas time. And, you know, even though, you know, all the tension, all the turmoil and, you know, all this and that going on, you know, it's this month, let's, you know, not forget, you know, what Christmas means, which, you know, I'm sure we will talk about, you know, in the next few shows around, you know, this month of December.
Yeah. It's about celebrating the birth of Jesus.
Exactly.
Okay, well, thank you for joining me, Cato.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Slattery, for another show.
Okay, and I will be back again tomorrow with another exciting episode of National Legal Radio.
Orkestra.